on the line interview program here on the at the commentary.ca. The new funny and insightful novel, The Messiah of Morris Avenue, takes a satirical and perhaps prescient look at the way America could look like if the religious right wins the culture wars, as well how that not too distant America would react to the second coming of Jesus Christ. Joining me today is its author, the one and only Tony Hendra. Tony Hendra is the acclaimed satirist who was once editor-in-chief of Spy Magazine, a founding editor of National Lampoon, and the author of the remarkably wonderful memoir Father Joe, which incidentally is a book that I still think about from time to time. He's also remembered for his portrayal of Ian Faith in the motion picture This Is Spinal Tap, The Messiah of Morris Avenue, is published by Henry Holt and retails for $32 Canadian. I am pleased to welcome to Planta on the line Tony Hendra. Good morning, Mr. Hendra.
Good morning, Jeff.
You're in Texas this morning?
I'm in Austin, Texas, yes.
I suspect that the reaction to this book is perhaps different there than it would be in Manhattan where you live. Is it or is it not?
Well, I mean, I've only been here for a few hours, but actually, no. Austin is a little bit anomalous in Texas. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, West Texas backwards Christianity here. Austin is very cosmopolitan and I would say progressive. So, you know, I was on a radio show this morning, and the guys were laughing their butts off about it. So that was a good sign. But there are going to be other places I go, you know, where that's not the case. I'm headed for Kansas tomorrow. We'll see. We'll see what happens in Kansas.
Yeah. So sort of set the scene for us. The religious right has won. I said it was the not too distant future.
Right.
How far from today would it be?
Well, I try not to be tremendously specific about it, but in a nutshell, it's about a decade hence. And the basic premise is that the U.S. has become the Christian right has achieved all of its fondest dreams, and the U.S. is in to all intents and purposes a theocracy. And so, for example, you have a Supreme Court, which is now all nine of them are Christian men, and true, and so they call themselves the Supreme Court under God, and they have ordered that the Ten Commandments be posted not just in schools and courthouses, but everywhere sin might raise its seductive head, as they put it. Bars, gyms, swimming pools, country club cabanas, motel check-ins, Catholic sacristies, you name it. You'll get your 4-foot-high Ten Commandments staring at you. And, you know, there's other things. D.C. in Washington, D.C. now stands for Dominion of Christ. And that's actually a goal of some of these guys.
Is it really?
Yeah, I mean, and another goal which they're actually talking about is that there are now federal statutes making blasphemy, sodomy, and witchcraft felonies. And so, for example, witchcraft is basically directed at it's obviously directed at British boy wizards and bewitched reruns, but it's mostly directed at environmentalism because the Christian right believes that environmentalism is the pagan worship of nature, and so that's why we would want to outlaw witchcraft. And there's a Secretary of Salvation who sits right along the Secretary of Defense in the cabinet, and as the book opens, he's actually hosting the first faith-based Academy Awards in downtown Hollywood.
Hollywood,
yes, yeah. Being renamed.
That's Reverend James Sabbath, right?
That is indeed.
In reading the book, he strikes me as probably being the most powerful man in America.
Well, yes, I think that's very much the case. I mean, his church is probably 100 million strong, and it's in my book at least they're called the Pure Holy Baptists, but it's pretty thinly veiled. Picture of the Southern Baptist Convention, which is certainly has wields with this particular person in power, wields a colossal amount of power. So, you know, whoever's heading up the SBC is a big, big wheel.
I asked how far we are from actually coming to this, and it could be a possibility. Who knows? Probably not, but you never know. One of the interesting things that you bring up is that the Pentagon is privatized. Would you go into that, and what kind of wars are they fighting then?
Well, that basically frees them up to fight whatever wars are most profitable, because they're the ones, you know, they're now responsible for their own profits. They get a grant from the government, an annual grant. But, for example, it's a very good. There is one of the main people in the Pentagon chain of command these days is something called the he's the officer who's in charge of infrastructure destruction, and that means going to small countries and bombing the crap out of them and then making them pay for their own renovation. So, you know, pretty much what we're doing in Iraq. It makes a lot of money.
Yeah. I was going to say that this was a nonfiction book, but no, this is a novel. the person that, the Messiah of Morris Avenue, despite his Kennedy last name, he's a Hispanic kid. Right. Morris Avenue's in the Bronx, if people didn't know. Now, he is the son of God, is he?
That's what he says, and he certainly seems to be convincing a number of people. I mean, one of the things that has to be said is that, as I'm sure most people are aware, this book is in many ways is about who Christ is. I mean, or who he would be if he did return. And obviously, the glue, not just in my book of the theocracy, but also of the actual Christian right, is that they are, to a man and woman, passionate believers in the fact that we are in the end times, and that Christ is about to return. You know, in the sort of mighty Lieutenant J. Christ USMC, who will destroy billions of Pat Robertson's enemies, starting with, you know, Susan Sarandon and most of NPR. But that's a real conviction that these people have, and it's one of the things that keeps them going. It's one of the things that makes their effect on policy so dangerous, because they really do think the Earth is coming to an end. So what's the point of, you know, for example, doing something about global warming? It's all going to be over next Tuesday anyway. So there's that figure of Christ is what is promoted by the theocracy, and of course, when the person who might very well be the real Christ comes back, he comes back as he did last time in a very poor and forgotten part of the country, and he's poor himself, and he moves amongst the poor, and he is in every way very ordinary. He wears a hoodie. He, you know, drives a beat up GMC van. He played varsity basketball in school. He's just one of us, and that I think is the overall point that I'm really trying to make here.
Mark Twain said that if Christ came back, the Christians would crucify him. Is that what we see in the book?
Well, you're giving away my book now, Jay.
Well, I mean, let's.
But yes, he did say that, and that is, in that sort of faces in two directions. Yes, my story does unfold in a way that any wouldn't have to be Christian to recognize the way it unfolds. But it also is a commentary, I think, on the sort of timeless nature of this premise. It's not a new premise. People have thought this in many ways, and, you know, at many times, and they always have very much the same conclusion, which is that the Christ, you know, the bellicose Christ who is coming to judge any specific group's enemies, is not what Christ was at all biblically, and there's, you know, the truth is far more interesting and far more redemptive.
I was interested to find out how much of yourself is in some of these characters, especially Johnny Greco. Now, he's the narrator of the book. He's a cynical, hardened New York reporter.
Right.
Where did you get the inspiration for him?
Well, I mean, he's obviously, I spent a lot of my life as a journalist of sorts. I mean, I've always thought that satire is actually a form of journalism, if you want to look at it that way, in the sense that, real good satire tells, it doesn't deal with facts, certainly. It deals with what I call super facts, which are really sort of exaggerated versions of real facts that lead you quicker to the truth than any number of real facts can. So, I mean, I think that that I've been a journalist on and off through most of my life, but I'm also acutely aware, as I discussed, I mean, this was a theme that I took up in Father Joe, of how much damage being the kind of person who destroys other people for a living, or at least tears down their reputations and so on, what sort of moral effect that has on oneself, you know. And so I think the inspiration for Johnny comes from things that I have experienced, and also things that I see in others. Johnny is very cynical, very jaded, but he's also very self-critical, and to the degree that you know, all of us born Catholics tend to be pretty self-critical. I guess that's myself for him. But another, I mean, the other point about Johnny is that he's a non-believer, and even when he comes in contact with this Latino guy, whose name is Jose, but everyone calls him Jay, he finds himself not believing in him, but very moved by him, and he finds him very charismatic, and actually has an experience of what is for Johnny close to spirituality, I think, in his presence, which I think is also an interesting sort of contrast.
What did you think of the whole, because in the book, Johnny writes that he is Jay's Judas. What did you make of this whole Gospel of Judas thing?
Well, I mean, speaking as a sort of self-taught historian of the church, which I certainly haven't got any great bona fides in, but it is a fact that this particular heresy, as the church would have called it, is not new. I mean, there were always people who had what I would call a determinist view of of the passion that Christ knew all along it was going to happen, and that so Judas isn't to be blamed for being swept up in the necessity for salvation, which the church has always come down heavily on that because it denies the idea of free will. I know this is all getting rather theological, but it's a very tempting kind of interpretation to put on the Gospels. And in fact, the first thing I thought of actually was Nikos Kazantzakis' book, The Last Temptation of Christ. Judas' character is very important in that and very powerful, and it's exactly the same as the Gospel of Judas, which is that Christ basically tells Judas to betray him. So it's an old theme, you know.
We're talking with Tony Hendra. The book is called The Messiah of Morris Avenue, $32 Canadian, published by Henry Holt. You mentioned Pat Robertson earlier. I suspect that perhaps he and Jerry Falwell were the inspiration for the Reverend James Sabbath. Maybe not. I don't know. I'm very interested because I reread Father Joe over the weekend.
Okay.
The Christianity that he instilled in you seems awfully different than that they preach. Can you reconcile those two schools of Christian thought or not?
Well, no, I don't think you can, and I don't care to. I'm deeply of the conviction that, in fact, I just wrote a piece in the Huffington Post about this, which is that I don't believe the Christ of the Christian right is a Christian. And this, as I said, this bellicose mass murderer that they're hoping to come back and take revenge on all their, not just their enemies, but somehow sort of all those who have frustrated them in their lives and caused the disappointments and failures in them and so on. It's a very vengeful version of Christ, and I don't think there's any biblical foundation for that, even though these people, the Robertsons and Falwells and Tony Perkinses and all the rest of them, including George W. Bush, are supposedly literal Bible readers. But I don't see that in the Bible at all, and I don't think, certainly not in the Gospels. So I'm deeply opposed to that kind of Christianity, and I'm as a practicing Catholic, which is to say I need a lot of practice. I think we should do a lot more to ridicule and combat this grotesque interpretation of Christianity, which is being promoted, you know, as if they had a monopoly on this. The Christianity that Father Joe imbued me with, I think, was much closer to what Christ actually was and what he taught, which is humility comes first. The blessed are the poor in spirit, that's pretty explicit. Love your enemies. What does that have to say about war, and even just war? I mean, you have to grasp these nettles if you're going to deal with the teachings of this guy who walked around in Judea 2,000 years ago. Even though they're coming through layers and layers of translation and so on, it's very clear what he said. You know, be wise as serpents and gentle as doves. Do you think that's Pat Robertson or Jerry Falwell? I don't think so.
But how do you change? I mean, a lot of people, I mean, you look at the people do subscribe to the Falwells and the Robertsons and those sort of Fox News and those sorts of ideas.
Right.
This is, I guess, a political question now. The whole right in the United States is very powerful, and liberals and Democrats, they seem to be, they can't seem to to win people's hearts and minds, to use that phrase.
Well, I mean, there's many answers to that. I think one is what I've already sort of set out to do, which is all I know how to do is write. So, I mean, Father Joe, I think one of the reasons Father Joe was a success, and I think Messiah's going to be a success, is that it presented a very different kind of Christian and a very different kind of Christianity than the one that we're bombarded with all the time. And I think people saw that as a great relief, you know, from these terrorists. That's really what they are. They're spreading terror, fundamentalist terrorists. That's what Robertson and et al. Are. And to have the true or much truer version of Christianity actually embodied in a man called Father Joe was a great surprise for a lot of people, I think, and a pleasant one. And I hope the same thing will happen with Messiah, because that's really what I set out to do, to try and create. It's a little bit of a fantasy world, I suppose, but I mean, I would love to have such a figure by my side and confront Jerry Falwell and say, you know, have him say to Falwell, just what is it about thou shalt not kill that you don't get? It's not that complicated a commandment. Love thy enemies is very explicit. What about that don't you get, Jerry? And I think that's that's all I can do. I can just write about it, dramatize it, and I wish more of those who do not agree with the Christian right would stand up and stop being so accommodating and loving and everything else like that. We have the absolute obligation to respect what anyone wants to believe in this country, but that doesn't mean we have to respect what they believe. And if it's genocidal garbage like, the stuff that George Bush believes in, then we have a duty to fight it.
Let's get back to the book for just a second.
Okay.
You talked about because I'm just looking at the clock, and there's a number of things I want to ask you. But
okay.
One of the interesting things that I found, and I've never been to New York, but I got a real sense that New York plays a very big, and New York and the surrounding area plays a very big part in the novel, almost a character in and of itself.
Right.
And you talked about the novel being set in a sort of fantasy world. Paint us a cityscape of what that New York would look like, and how far is it off to being that being a Trump world, if you will?
Well, I think, New York is New York. I think one of the reasons there was some practical reasons I said it in New York, and I love New York. That's where I live, and I think New York is likely to become possibly more and more isolated, or would become more and more isolated culturally in every other way if a southern-driven theocracy actually took hold, or took even stronger hold than it already has. So New York, I would think, is a bastion of resistance, and that's kind of the way I see it. But a lot of it just has to do with, trends that are already, in place. Trump is perhaps an easy target, but I certainly do posit that, what I regard as his real estate predations have worked their way up the Hudson, this wonderful, splendid, glorious river which we're lucky enough to live beside, so you can't see the damn thing unless you live in one of his towers, that's already happening in the Upper West Side. So it's that kind of thing. But on the other hand, I do think that as I call them, the Faith, Hope, and No Charity Brigade, meaning the Christian right, would have no sympathy whatsoever with any of the urban poor, so that the Bronx would be even more dilapidated than it already is. And the last thing is that I go to a church around the corner from where I live on the Upper West Side, and it's about 60-65% Central American. I find Latino spirituality quite electrifying. So a lot of that was helped fuel what I think is the kind of place of this book.
I wanted to ask you about how you write. Do you use a computer? Do you write in longhand?
No, I use a computer, I'm ashamed to say. I know I inveigh against screens and so on all the time, but actually I find using a laptop is really the best way. This is my first novel, so it was a great voyage of all kinds of discovery, and one was that writing novels is really difficult. Telling a story of that length and detail requires an enormous amount of concentration. In my case, it involved about writing about five times as much as actually came out as a book.
Are you working on a new novel now, or what are you working on now?
Yes, I am. Well, I'm not yet writing it, but I have a very clear plan on what I want my next book to be, which is Father Joe obviously was a very important groundbreaking book for me, and it's no accident that my Messiah's name is the Spanish for Joe. But I always wanted to do another book about Father Joe himself, and so I decided I want to write a fictional book and put Father Joe back in the Middle Ages in a Benedictine monastery in the 11th century. So that's what it's going to be about.
God, I can't wait for that. do you read the reviews for your books, for this book especially? Because a number have come out already. Do you read the reviews of your books?
I don't. There are some that I read and a lot that I don't. I've actually been much more interested this time around in the online reviews. I think that the future of book sales and book retailing in general is very much on the web. And they're the ones that I think are most significant. With a very few exceptions, I don't think major newspapers, except maybe the Times, have much of an influence one way or the other on books anymore. But there are places, there are destinations on the web where it's extremely important what people say.
The last question I want to ask has it's a sort of personal question. You have been regarded as a satirist and talented beyond belief, some people think. Father Joe was, of course, a departure, as you said, from that satirical world that you write about. I was surprised that this was your first novel, incidentally. With Father Joe, people regarded you not only as a satirist but a spiritualist. The controversy about the book aside, Father Joe, the stuff about your daughter and stuff like that, that aside, it still stands out as a deeply spiritual book, whether you're Catholic or not.
Right.
Do you carry this mantle of spiritualist around, or are you still a satirist?
Well, I would have to say that to me, spiritualist means someone who sits in a darkened room and tries to channel, the dead.
Right.
But, so I'm not that. But I think as much as anything, Father Joe was a story about, if not rediscovering one's faith in the sense of going back to the way you believed when you were a teenager, it's definitely a book about spiritual reawakening and how important that can be to one's life. So. I would say that I am deeply interested and moved and concerned by matters spiritual, which aren't necessarily all Christian. But that doesn't mean that when I get my teeth into something, I'm not going to let them rip.
But how do you feel about people looking to you to explain deeply religious things and faith-based things? Do you accept that sort of responsibility?
I'm not sure that I want to be a teacher. I think that's sort of why I didn't pursue. I wanted to do this as a fictional story because I think it's more important to provoke debate and thought about these things than it is to instruct. I think it's a very, very hard and dangerous road to go to take on that responsibility, I suppose. But, I mean, I do find and have found with some of the reviews of this book already that people are very struck by, the ways I conceive to restate things. And in an area like religion, I don't think there's anything new under the sun. But I think we do need to have an obligation every generation to restate and rework and revisit and truths that are always there inside us.
Tony, this has been so fascinating. We could talk longer, but I ought to let you go.
Okay.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, a great pleasure.
And continued good luck with this book. It had me laughing out loud. Do pick it up. It's called The Messiah of Morris Avenue, 32.